Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Monday, March 10, 2014. We've doubled our listenership in Costa Rica. And Medea Benjamin survived her trip to Cairo. Medea Benjamin traveled to Cairo to gain access to the Gaza Strip. She was leading a delegation of 100 women from all over the world going to Gaza to observe International Women's Day. And Medea Benjamin, in our exclusive interview, tells me that they had made arrangements with the Egyptian authorities and thought everything was going quite well. But as part of the advance team, when Benjamin herself, co-founder of Code Pink for Peace, arrived at the Cairo airport, things went sideways.
And the Egyptian government was cooperating with us. So the last thing I thought was that I would have problems at the airport. But indeed, I was one of the earliest to arrive, and I was taken aside and kept without any explanation of what was wrong. And then after a while, thrown into a cell overnight. And the next day, five plainclothes police with handcuffs came in. And I said, please, you know, wait for my embassy, because I'd been trying all night long to get the embassy. And I heard they were on their way. And I said, I think there's some miscommunication. Can we just wait till the embassy gets here? We've been working with your foreign ministry. And instead of letting me wait, they threw me to the ground violently, stomped on my back, yanked my arm so tight that my arm fell out, popped out of its socket, put these very excruciatingly tight handcuffs on me, and dragged me by the arm out of the socket through the halls of the airport. And while I was screaming out in pain, they stuffed the scarf that I had on into my mouth to stop me from screaming, brought me to where there was a Turkish airline, the tarmac of where the plane was, and was about to throw me on the plane in this pain when they brought up an ambulance, and the doctor said, no, she's in no shape to travel. We have to get her to a hospital. But the security wouldn't let me leave the airport.
As you'll hear in the full interview released to subscribers today at peterbcollins.com, Medea Benjamin is in severe pain, her shoulder completely dislocated, and they flew her to Istanbul before she was able to grab a flight back to the United States. Now, the events in Gaza did go on as scheduled, and Colonel Ann Wright, a longtime friend of this program, took the place of Medea Benjamin in leading the Code Pink delegation. As I mentioned at the top, we picked up a new listener in Costa Rica. I went to my post office box over the weekend. And by the way, if you send something to the P.O. box, I go there probably about twice a month. So if you don't get an immediate response, that is why. But Tom Burton dropped a check in the mail for an annual subscription, a new one, at peterbcollins.com, and notified me that he's living in Costa Rica these days. And Tom doubles our audience because Larry Doers, and actually triples, whatever. We now have at least three known listeners in Costa Rica, Larry and his wife Janet, longtime listeners and subscribers to the Peter B. Collins podcast. Also, I want to thank people who have earmarked funds to the new audio upgrade fund here at peterbcollins.com. And by the way, later this week, we're going to replace the computer that we record these shows on because it has continued to produce skipping audio files. And we are really frustrated by that. We apologize for it. And the new computer should solve that problem. But we've been supported by Steve Phillips, who kicked in $50, Joe Davis in Pasadena sent a check for $25 just for the audio fund, and one of our longest-running subscribers and a very generous man, Paul Elsesser, increased his monthly check to $100 to help us out with the audio upgrade. I'm really touched by your support and very grateful. And I want to ask those who haven't contributed to consider it. Go to peterbcollins.com. You can get a 24-hour pass for $1. Our monthly subscriptions, $5, $10, $20, depending on what you can afford. Or the best deal, our $50 annual subscription gets you the bonus gifts. Right now, that includes this rockin' CD called Red Flag by John Dist and a bag of kick-ass Kona coffee beans supplied by our friend Russ Archibald on the Big Island of Hawaii. I also want to ask you, whether you subscribe or not, to take the offer for a free one-month trial at audible.com. You get your first audiobook download free, and you can cancel within a month. You don't have to pay Audible anything. But for my referring you to try it out, Audible will send $15 to the trust fund that subsidizes the Peter B. Collins podcast. Thank you, one and all, for your support. Edward Snowden made an appearance in Austin, Texas today, and I'm sure he'd love to be partying down with all the South by Southwesters. What is that, 6th Street with all the bars in Austin? I've been a couple of times. It's a blast. And what's very interesting, I have two reports on Ed Snowden's video appearance at South by Southwest. The first doesn't tell us much. It's from the New York Times, and it acknowledges that Snowden made the appearance, and it's a very sketchy article, byline Jenna Wortham, never heard of Jenna before, and it really skirts the meat of what Ed Snowden told the crowd at South by Southwest. According to the Times, he basically just talked to early technology adopters and entrepreneurs and said that those people at South by Southwest are the folks who can fix this and enforce our rights. Snowden said that even the companies whose business models rely on collecting data about their users can still do this in a responsible way. It's not that you shouldn't collect the data, he said, but you should only collect the data and hold it as long as necessary. Now, that's the only quote that you get from Ed Snowden in the New York Times. And everything else that I'm about to disclose to you about Ed Snowden's commentary in Austin is from the Guardian newspaper published in Britain. And let's credit their reporter, Jemima Kiss, in Austin. So, according to the Guardian, Ed Snowden had a lot more to say, including that he would do it all again, despite the personal sacrifices that he has endured. He said that, and by the way, I found out that he used Google Hangout to connect up the video conference with Austin, and they had set up 7 different proxies. Still, there were hiccups and interruptions as Snowden responded to questions from Twitter and made his own commentary. He said that as he appeared in front of an image of the U.S. Constitution, he said he'd taken an oath to protect it, but had seen it violated on a mass scale while working for the U.S. government. He accepted praise from Sir Tim Berners-Lee, the inventor of the World Wide Web, who got to ask the first question and complimented Snowden as acting profoundly in the public interest. So the article continues, the session provided a rare and extensive glimpse into the thoughts of Snowden, granted temporary asylum by Russia after the U.S. Revoked his passport. He struck back strongly against claims made again last week by the NSA director Alexander that his release of secret documents to The Guardian and other outlets had weakened American cyber defenses. Quote, these things are improving national security. These are improving the communications not just of Americans but everyone in the world, Snowden said. He went on, because we rely on the same standard, we rely on the ability to trust our communications, and without that, we don't have anything. He said that more secure communication activity has been encouraged by his disclosures. The public has benefited, the government has benefited, every society has benefited, he said. He rejected claims that potential adversaries like Russia and China had obtained the files he'd been carrying. That has never happened, and it's never going to happen. All right, that's pretty clear. He said, when you're and then he criticized the U.S. for collecting all this data, but not being able to use it to find suspects. And also that they don't guard their own back door, referring to his ability to access highly classified, top secret information. He said, when you're the one country in the world that has a vault that is more full than everyone else's, it doesn't make any sense to be attacking all day and never defending. And it makes even less sense when you let the standards for vaults worldwide have a big back door that anyone can walk in. And he's talking about what he did. And then he tweaked the government for example, failing to pick up would-be terrorists like Tamerlan Tsarnaev, one of the brothers alleged to have bombed the Boston Marathon last year. He said, we're monitoring everyone's communications rather than suspects' communications. If we hadn't spent so much on mass surveillance, if we had followed traditional patterns, we might have caught him. He said that while the U.S. has an oversight model that could work to guard against excess by intelligence agencies, in reality it had proved ineffectual. Then he slammed James Clapper, the perjurer of the who heads the Office of National Intelligence. Snowden said Clapper had shown officials can lie to the country, lie to the Congress, and face not even a criticism. And he noted that he recently became the victim of hacking when a scan of his American passport was released online, having been taken from the files of a professional organization that gives certification to ethical hackers. He's now a victim of the system that he used to be a part of. And to his quote, would I do this again? The answer is absolutely yes. Regardless of what happens to me, this is something we had a right to know. And previously, the New York Times ran a story on Saturday based on written remarks that Ed Snowden provided to members of the European Parliament. In it, he said that he had tried to go to superiors before he went public. He said he raised his concerns to more than 10 officials, none of whom took any action to address them. He said there were kind of two types of response. One was that people would respond with well-meaning but hushed warnings not to rock the boat for fear of retaliation, like being investigated by the FBI as a suspected leaker. He said other people told him to let the issue be someone else's problem. Quote, even among the most senior individuals to whom I reported my concerns, no one at NSA could ever recall an instance where an official complaint had resulted in an unlawful program being ended. But there was a unanimous desire to avoid being associated with such a complaint in any form. So that's the latest from Ed Snowden today. Meanwhile, at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, in the trial of the 82nd Airborne's Brigadier General Jeff Sinclair, it's gotten messier because the judge is asserting that there may have been a kind of unlawful command influence regarding an effort by General Sinclair to engage in a plea bargain. And this was raised on Friday. The judge got more evidence over the weekend. And what we have here is the potential that those in the chain of command either interfered to block a plea bargain because of the politics of the crisis about sexual assault in the military today and the message that that would send. And, of course, they were trying not to draw too much attention in order to keep the bill authored by Senator Kirsten Gillibrand of New York from passing. That's the one that would take prosecutions out of the chain of command and require independent prosecutors. So Colonel James Pohl, who is presiding over this court-martial, said that he will give Sinclair's legal team until tomorrow morning to file a new plea offer. And if Sinclair doesn't do that, the trial will continue. If he does, it appears it will be sidetracked into a discussion of the plea bargain possibilities. And in any event, this is just another example of how generals get treated differently from lower-ranking individuals. And it's an open question right now whether the captain, the female captain, who had a 3-year affair with Sinclair, that's not in dispute, and she has immunity for her testimony against charges of adultery and those other unbecoming an officer charges that relate to having a sexual affair while you're serving in the military and in a combat situation. So it's possible that she has concocted the charges of sexual assault, specifically that Sinclair forced her to perform oral sex on him on multiple occasions. It's possible she made that up. But what we have evolving here, with Sinclair taking a guilty plea to the porn charges, the adultery charges, boils down to he said, she said. And she said in her testimony on the stand last Friday that her biggest fear was that she could bring charges and they just say, well, it's your word against his. He said, she said. And who's got the most stars on his or her uniform in this case? And that is the conundrum that she faced. And again, I wasn't there. I don't know who did what to whom. But my bias is in favor of a victim who would not go to the trouble of bringing these charges in such an uphill struggle, as you can see from anyone who has taken on a rape or sexual assault while serving in the military. So that's my bias. We'll see how it all shakes out. Grab your C-SPAN, your popcorn, whatever you like for late night imbibing. Maybe it's a bottle of wine. It could be a 40. It could be a cocktail. I don't know what you like to sip. 26 Democrats are planning an all-nighter on the Senate floor, and it's not a filibuster. This is a marathon about climate change, and it's driven by one of the newest members of the Senate, Ed Markey, who took the seat from Massachusetts that was vacated when John Kerry became Secretary of State. Markey was a great liberal member of the House of Representatives. He made climate change the centerpiece of his campaign when he ran for the Senate last year, and he is following through on that commitment. So they don't expect to pass a bill this year, I'm sorry to say, but they're hoping to draw attention to the climate change issue. It'll be very interesting to see in these floor speeches how many of them talk about the Keystone XL pipeline. Will they talk about fracking? Will they talk about the danger of using tar sands, the dirtiest crude available on the planet? Or will they, kind of like that new Cosmos show that was on last night, just use a lot of wow video and kind of talk around the science? One thing we can be pretty certain of, that Mark Begich, senator from Alaska, Mary Landrieu, senator for oil and gas from Louisiana, and Mark Pryor of Arkansas, they're not likely to be present. If anything, they will speak out against the liberal climate change caucus of the U.S. Senate. And our friend Steve Horn over at DSmog Blog has an important report, because one of the issues about fracking, whether you're fracking for natural gas from an ordinary deposit or from a shale deposit, is that critics have argued that while you're getting natural gas, which is cleaner burning than coal, the way you extract the natural gas produces a lot of waste, and methane, one of the most carbon-rich gases that is produced through human activity like this, methane leaks out of the site where they're using fracking to extract natural gas. And in the Bakken Shale in North Dakota, in the month of December alone, testimony before Congress last week revealed that almost 36% of the natural gas that was coming from these shale fields in North Dakota was intentionally being flared off. And flared off means that as it leaves the wellhead, they burn it. And the leak of the methane gas is bad enough, but when you burn it, I believe it produces even more carbon. And so this underscores the wasteful way that the exploiters of our resources are managing them. And if you look at the massive waste that is likely occurring at sites all over the country, you have to ask yourself, do we really need this? I don't think we do. And can we live with the pollution that it causes? I'll link to Steve's article and encourage you to read it for yourself. This is a curious, somewhat perplexing report from the border between the West Bank and Jordan. These events occurred on Sunday, American time. I take that back. It occurred on Monday. Israeli troops at a border crossing shot dead a Palestinian who's a citizen of Jordan and who was a judge. And the Israelis say that he allegedly tried to snatch a weapon from an Israeli soldier, which is what triggered or provoked this shooting. Now, we have many more questions than answers. An Israeli army statement said that a Palestinian attempted to seize the weapon of a soldier at the Allenby Bridge crossing from Jordan. And while the victim, a 38-year-old Ra'ed Zeiter, was originally from Palestine, he moved to Jordan several years ago and holds Jordanian citizenship, and he worked there as a judge. A Jordanian security official confirmed that Zeiter worked as a judge in Amman and had left for the West Bank early on Monday. He worked at a magistrate's court in the capital. And apparently he was on a bus with 40 or 50 people at the border crossing. And we don't have explicit allegations that it was Zeiter who reached for an Israeli weapon. So beyond that, we'll continue to look for more coverage, and we'll bring it to you if it does indeed occur. Now to the crisis in Ukraine. Russia has said today that it cannot accept the fait accompli of the new Western-backed government in Ukraine. And this is a point that's more than just quibbling. If there are going to be any negotiations over the future of the Kiev government, over the status of Crimea, where do you start? Do you start with the point where Yanukovych had fled Kiev and the parliament put itself in power, appointing some people from the streets who had been protesting, some from the Svoboda Party, which is described as nationalist and anti-Semitic? So we have a government that is not legitimate in Kiev. And I hasten to point out, as I mentioned last week, Chris Hayes is so far the only media person who has brought us the story that the Crimean parliament is stacked with pro-Russian sympathizers, and that prior to the vote to put a referendum on the ballot on March 10th, that's this Sunday, March 16th, this coming Sunday, that they had dismissed something like 97 members of the parliament and replaced them. I have yet to see this referenced in a major media outlet like the New York Times, and I think it is a critical factor. At any rate, the Times passes along speculation from the U.S. government that the Russian diplomatic move seemed to be delaying tactics as Russian forces acted more assertively in Crimea. And while the West recognizes the new interim government in Kiev, with presidential elections scheduled for May, Russia wants to return to the February 21st deal that was signed by the former President Yanukovych, agreeing to a new unity government and presidential elections in December. Now, it's unclear to me what Russia gains other than time, and the reports are that it is solidifying its control of virtually all the bases in Crimea. It's unclear exactly what their motives are in eastern Ukraine. But these issues produce some strong reactions from listeners to the Peter B. Collins podcast. Stuart Smith, who lives in Maine, wrote over the weekend, "Peter, I cannot understand why the story of Stalin's starvation of Ukraine is being ignored in all the coverage and synopsis of history. The subject of Holodomor, cannot even be referenced in front of one of his relatives, as the pain and devastation is still present with every Ukrainian. I'm going to link to a website that is based in Connecticut, run by an American group called Holodomor. And Holodomor, I'm told, is translated from Ukrainian, and it is the term that roughly means starving people to death. And Stuart writes about his own ancestry. My Aunt Rosie from the Bronx married a first-generation white Russian whose parents came to New Jersey in the early 20s with many other Hungarians, Poles, Czechs, Slavs, and Jews. This will never leave me. He says the Bolshevik Jews that hijacked the revolution within 6 months and put Lenin on the train to Finland, and later Stalin in power, were determined to eliminate the very Christian white Russians and Ukrainians from the mix. The Germans feared their own fate, and Hitler invaded Poland to stop them from advancing. So much old, untold and half-truth history. Let's really put it all out on the table. Well, thank you, Stuart. And also Andy Drawl, who lives on the West Coast here. He says, I'm intensely interested in the Ukrainian situation. My grandparents came from a rural area between Lviv, Ukraine, and Krakow, Poland. The last time I saw my grandmother in the late 70s, she pulled out a map of Eastern Europe and explained where she came from, near the then Czechoslovakian border. He said, I was in college at the time. She said my winter coat looked very bad, so she gave me some money to buy a new one. These were simple people that didn't have much of anything. When she's a little girl, she would ride a wagon to either Krakow or Lviv. Her family lived between both cities to sell their farm produce. She said those were the best memories of her childhood. My grandparents considered where they came from, Austria, arriving in the U.S., 15 to 20 years prior to World War I. And he said, I read the Robert Perry piece, and we've since interviewed Robert Perry and Ray McGovern, and certainly there is a neocon Victoria Nuland effort to bring Ukraine into the Western NATO sphere of influence. I do agree that Perry's piece is much closer to the truth than what we get from the corporate media, yet there are still many heroes in Ukraine who sacrifice their lives, working people and young professionals, to try to get a more perfect representative political system. And separately, Andy sent a comment on the report we gave you on Friday, based on David Sirota's reporting at Pando.com, about who owns the public television NewsHour. The company that owns it is McNeil Lehrer Productions, which bears the name of the two guys who used to co-anchor the NewsHour. But John Malone of Liberty Media, a cable mogul who also muscled his way into control of the only satellite radio franchise we have, Sirius XM, he controls 67%. And Andy says, I don't know how you've been able to watch this show throughout the years. Mark Shields, for one, truly makes me want to vomit. What a complete corporate fool and toady. Well, you have a point there, Andy. Speaking of the media, The New York Times ran a self-congratulatory lead editorial in Sunday's paper entitled The Uninhibited Press 50 Years Later. And here the gray lady celebrates her once greatness, going back 50 years to Alabama and a Supreme Court decision, Times versus Sullivan. That ruling changed libel law in the United States. And what's interesting is the Times has only once covered the case of our friend and colleague who is jailed in Alabama for a First Amendment crime, alleged. And it's based on libel law. He's been accused of defaming a powerful political figure, Rob Riley, in his coverage, Roger Schuller, over at the Legal Schnauzer blog. And the Times deserves credit for the courage it showed 50 years ago in confronting the evils of racism in the South and the use of libel laws to cover up coverage of the civil rights movement. But 50 years later, The Times is a shadow of its former self. And while it often does report the news accurately, you've got to work very hard to plow through the propaganda from our government, from corporate interests, that swells the pages of the newspaper that promises to bring you all the news that's fit to print. And it doesn't see fit to print a lot of important news. It typically takes the government's position on issues of war, of surveillance, of foreign policy. And I wish the Times today had even 10 or 20% of the courage it showed in the civil rights era, in the Vietnam era, in the Pentagon Papers era that it can be fully proud of, and its sharp decline in years since. Thanks for joining me today for News and Comment. This podcast is free, and you are free to share it with anyone. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.